Hello, I'm FNH, and this is the Cthulhu Podcast. This podcast, home on the web, is at cthulhupodcast.co.uk. Welcome to this, the 36th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. Today I continue reading with the next part of Teddy Roosevelt's book, Through the Brazilian Wilderness. And then we'll have a musical interlude, followed by part 10 of The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath by H.P. Lovecraft. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, part 5. But the effect of the venom of the poisonous colubine snake is totally different from, although to the full as deadly as, the effect of the poison of the rattlesnake or jararaca, the serum that is an antidote as regards the colubines. The animal that is immune to the bite of one may not be immune to the bite of the other. The bite of a cobra, or the colubine poisonous snake, is more painful in its immediate effects than is the bite of one of the big vipers. The victim suffers more. There is a greater effect on the nerve centres, but less swelling of the wound itself, and whereas the blood of the rattlesnake's victim coagulates, the blood of the victim of an epiline snake, that is, one of the only poisonous American colubines, becomes watery and incapable of coagulation. Snakes are highly specialized in every way, including their prey. Some live exclusively on warm-blooded animals, on mammals or birds. Some live exclusively on batrachians, others only on lizards, a few only on insects. A very few species live exclusively on other snakes. These include one very formidable venomous snake, the Indian hamadryad, or giant cobra, and several non-poisonous snakes. In Africa, I killed a small cobra which contained within it a snake but a few inch shorter than itself. But, as far as I could find out, snakes were not the habitual diet of the African cobras. The poisonous snakes use their venom to kill their victims, and also to kill any possible foe which they think menaces them. Some of them are good-tempered, and only fight if injured or seriously alarmed. Others are excessively irritable, and on rare occasions will even attack of their own accord when entirely unprovoked and unthreatened. On reaching Sao Paulo, on our southward journey from Rio to Montevideo, we drove out to the Instituto Serum Therapico, designed for the study of the effects of the venom of poisonous Brazilian snakes. Its director is Dr. Vital Brazil, who has performed a most extraordinary work and whose experiments and investigations are not only of the utmost value to Brazil, but will ultimately be recognized as the utmost value for humanity at large. I know of no institution of similar kind anywhere. It has a fine modern building, with all the best appliances, in which experiments are carried on with all kinds of serpents, living and dead, with the object of discovering all of the properties of their several kinds of venom, and of developing various anti-venom serums which nullify the effects of the different venoms. Every effort is made to teach the people at large, by practical demonstration in the open field, the lessons thus learned in the laboratory. One notable result has been the diminution in the mortality from snake bites in the province of Sao Paulo. In connection with his institute, and right by the laboratory, the doctor has a large serpentarium, in which quantities of the common poisonous and non-poisonous snakes are kept, and some of the rarer ones. He has devoted considerable time to the effort to find out if there are any natural enemies of the poisonous snakes of his country, and he has discovered that the most formidable enemy of many of the dangerous Brazilian snakes is a non-poisonous, entirely harmless, rather uncommon Brazilian snake, the Massurama. Of all the interesting things the doctor showed us, by far the most interesting was the opportunity of witnessing for ourselves the action of the Massurama towards a dangerous snake. The doctor first showed us specimens of the various important snakes, poisonous and non-poisonous, in alcohol. Then he showed us preparations of the different kinds of venom and of the different anti-venom serums, presenting us with some of the latter for use on our journey. He has been able to produce two distinct kinds of anti-venom serum, one to neutralize the virulent poison of the rattlesnake's bite, the other to neutralize the poison of the different snakes of the Lachecis genus. These poisons are somewhat different, and moreover, they appear to be some differences between the poisons of the different species of the Lachecis. In some cases the poison is nearly colourless, and in others, as in that of the Jararaca, whose poison I saw, it is yellow. But the vital difference is that between all these poisons of the pit vipers and the poisonous columbine snakes, such as the cobra and the coral snake. As yet, the doctor has not been able to develop anti-venom serum which will neutralize the poison of these columbine snakes. Practically, this is a matter of little consequence in Brazil, for the Brazilian coral snakes are dangerous only when mishandled by someone whose bare skin is exposed to the bite. The numerous accidents and fatalities continually occurring in Brazil are almost always to be laid to the account of several species of Lachecis and the single species of rattlesnake. Finally, the doctor took us to his lecture room to show us how he conducted his experiments. The various snakes were in boxes on one side of the room, under the care of a skilful and impassive assistant who handled them with the cool and fearless caution of the doctor himself. The poisonous ones were taken out by means of long-handled steel hook, and all that is necessary to do is to insert this under the snake and lift him off the ground. He is unable to escape, but he is unable to strike, for he cannot strike unless coiled, so as to give himself support and leverage. The table on which the snakes are laid is fairly large and smooth, differing in no way from an ordinary table. That's enough about snakes for now. Next up we'll have some music, and today it's from Abe Lyman's California Ambassador Hotel Orchestra, playing a 1928 track called A Jazz Holiday. So on to today's main feature. The marvellous Maureen O'Brien continues to read
The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadoth by H.P. Lovecraft, Part 10. Grey day had now come, and under that leaden northern sky, a picked detachment of ghouls filed into the noisome ship and took their seats on the rowers' benches. Carter had found them fairly apt at learning, and before night had risked several experimental trips around the harbor. Not till 3 days later, however, did he deem it safe to attempt the voyage of conquest. Then, the rowers trained, and the night-gaunts safely stowed in the forecastle, the party set sail at last. Pickman and the other chiefs gathering on deck and discussing models of approach and procedure. On the very first night, the howlings from the rock were heard. Such was their timbre that all the galley's crew shook visibly. But most of all trembled the three rescued ghouls, who knew precisely what those howlings meant. It was not thought best to attempt an attack by night. So the ship lay to under the phosphorescent clouds to wait for the dawn of a grayish day, when the light was ample and the howling still. The rowers resumed their strokes, and the galley drew closer and closer to that jagged rock whose granite pinnacles clawed fantastically at the dull sky. The sides of the rock were very steep, but on ledges here and there could be seen the bulging walls of queer windowless dwellings, and the low railings guarding traveled high roads. No ship of men had ever come so near the place, or at least had never come so near and departed again. But Carter and the ghouls were void of fear, and kept inflexibly on, rounding the eastern face of the rock and seeking the wharves, which the rescued trio described as being on the southern side, within a harbor formed of steep headlands. The headlands were prolongations of the island proper, and came so closely together that only one ship at a time might pass between them. There seemed to be no watchers on the outside, so the galley was steered boldly through the flume-like strait and into the stagnant, putrid harbor beyond. Here, however, all was bustle and activity, with several ships lying at anchor along a forbidding stone quay, and scores of almost human slaves and moon beasts by the waterfront, handling crates and boxes, or driving nameless and fabulous horrors hitched to lumbering lorries. There was a small stone town hewn out of the vertical cliff above the wharves, with the start of a winding road that spiraled out of sight toward higher ledges of the rock. Of what lay inside that prodigious peak of granite, none might say, but the things one saw on the outside were far from encouraging. At sight of the incoming galley, the crowds on the wharves displayed much eagerness, those with eyes staring intently, and those without eyes wriggling their pink tentacles expectantly. They did not, of course, realize that the black ship had changed hands, for ghouls look much like the horned and hooved almost humans, and the night-gaunts were all out of sight below. By this time the leaders had fully formed a plan, which was to loose the night-gaunts as soon as the wharf was touched, and then to sail directly away, leaving matters wholly to the instincts of those almost mindless creatures. Marooned on the rock, the horned flyers would first of all seize whatever living things they found there, and afterward, quite helpless to think except in terms of the homing instinct, would forget their fears of water and fly swiftly back to the abyss, bearing their noisome prey to appropriate destinations in the dark, from which not much would emerge alive. The ghoul that was Pickman now went below and gave the night-gaunts their simple instructions, while the ship drew very near to the ominous and malodorous wharves. Presently a fresh stir arose along the waterfront, and Carter saw that the motions of the galley had begun to excite suspicion. Evidently the steersman was not making for the right dock, and probably the watchers had noticed the difference between the hideous ghouls and the almost human slaves whose places they were taking. Some silent alarm must have been given, for almost at once a horde of the mephitic moon-beasts began to pour from the little black doorways of the windowless houses and down the winding road at the right. A rain of curious javelins struck the galley as the prow hit the wharf, felling two ghouls and slightly wounding another. But at this point all the hatches were thrown open to emit a black cloud of whirring night-gaunts, which swarmed over the town like a flock of horned and cyclopean bats. The jellyish moon-beasts had procured a great pull, and were trying to push off the invading ship. But when the night-gaunts struck them, they thought of such things no more. It was a very terrible spectacle to see those faceless and rubbery ticklers at their pastime, and tremendously impressive to watch the dense cloud of them spreading through the town and up the winding roadway to the reaches above. Sometimes a group of the black flutterers would drop a toad-like prisoner from aloft by mistake, and the manner in which the victim would burst was highly offensive to the sight and smell. When the last of the night-gaunts had left the galley, the ghoulish leaders glibbered an order of withdrawal, and the rowers pulled quietly out of the harbor between the gray headlands, while still the town was a chaos of battle and conquest. The Pikmin ghoul allowed several hours for the night-gaunts to make up their rudimentary minds and overcome their fear of flying over the sea, and kept the galley standing about a mile off the jagged rock while he waited, and dressed the wounds of the injured men. Night fell, and the gray twilight gave place to the sickly phosphorescence of low clouds. And all the while, the leaders watched the high peaks of that accursed rock for signs of the night-gaunt's flight. Toward morning, a black speck was seen hovering timidly over the topmost pinnacle, and shortly afterward the speck had become a swarm. Just before daybreak the swarm seemed to scatter, and within a quarter of an hour it had vanished wholly in the distance toward the northeast. Once or twice something seemed to fall from the thing's swarm into the sea. But Carter did not worry, since he knew from observation that the toad-like moon-beasts cannot swim. At length, when the ghouls were satisfied that all the night-gaunts had left for Sarkomand and the Great Abyss with their doomed burdens, the galley put back into the harbor betwixt the gray headlands, and all the hideous company landed and roamed curiously over the denuded rock with its towers and eyries and fortresses chiseled from the solid stone. Frightful were the secrets uncovered in those evil and windowless crypts, for the remnants of unfinished pastimes were many, and in various stages of departure from their primal state. Carter put out of the way certain things which were, after a fashion, alive, and fled precipitately from a few other things about which he could not be very positive. The stench-filled houses were furnished mostly with grotesque stools and benches carven from moon-trees, and were painted inside with nameless and frantic designs. Countless weapons, implements, and ornaments lay about, including some large idols of solid ruby, depicting singular beings not found on the earth. These latter did not, despite their material, invite either appropriation or long inspection, and Carter took the trouble to hammer five of them into very small pieces. The scattered spears and javelins he collected, and with Pikmin's approval, distributed among the ghouls. Such devices were new to the dog-like lopers, but their relative simplicity made them easy to master after a few concise hints. The upper parts of the rock held more temples than private homes, and in numerous hewn chambers were found terrible carven altars and doubtfully stained fonts and shrines for the worship of things more monstrous than the wild gods atop Kadath. From the rear of one great temple stretched a low black passage, which Carter followed far into the rock with a torch, till he came to a lightless domed hall of vast proportions, whose vaultings were covered with demoniac carvings, and in whose center yawned a foul and bottomless well, like that in the hideous monastery of Leng, where broods alone the high priest not to be described. On the distant shadowy side, beyond the noisome well, he thought he discerned a small door of strangely wrought bronze. But for some reason he felt an unaccountable dread of opening it or even approaching it, and hastened back through the cavern to his unlovely allies, as they shambled about with an ease and abandon he could scarcely feel. The ghouls had observed the unfinished pastimes of the moon beasts, and had profited in their fashion. They had also found a hogshead of potent moon wine, and were rolling it down to the wharves for removal and later use in diplomatic dealings, though the rescued trio, remembering its effect on them in Dylath Lean, had warned their company to taste none of it. Of rubies from lunar mines there was a great store, both rough and polished, in one of the vaults near the water. But when the ghouls found they were not good to eat, they lost all interest in them. Carter did not try to carry any away, since he knew too much about those which had mined them. Suddenly there came an excited meeping from the sentries on the wharves, and all the loathsome foragers turned from their tasks to stare seaward and cluster round the waterfront. Betwixt the grey headlands a fresh black galley was rapidly advancing, and it would be but a moment before the almost humans on deck would perceive the invasion of the town, and give the alarm to the monstrous things below. Fortunately, the ghouls still bore the spears and javelins which Carter had distributed amongst them, and at his command, sustained by the being that was Pikmin, they now formed a line of battle, and prepared to prevent the landing of the ship. Presently a burst of excitement on the galley told of the crew's discovery of the changed state of things, and the instant stoppage of the vessel proved that the superior numbers of the ghouls had been noted and taken into account. After a moment of hesitation, the newcomers silently turned and passed out between the headlands again. But not for an instant did the ghouls imagine that the conflict was averted. Either the dark ship would seek reinforcements, or the crew would try to land elsewhere on the island. Hence a party of scouts was at once sent up toward the pinnacle, to see what the enemy's course would be. In a very few minutes the ghoul returned, breathless, to say that the moon beasts and almost humans were landing on the outside of the more easterly of the rugged grey headlands, and ascending by hidden paths and ledges which a goat could scarcely tread in safety. Almost immediately afterward the galley was sighted again through the flume-like strait, but only for a second. Then a few moments later a second messenger panted down from aloft to say that another party was landing on the other headland, both being much more numerous than the size of the galley would seem to allow for. The ship itself, moving slowly, with only one sparsely manned tier of oars, soon hove into sight betwixt the cliffs, and lay to in the fetid harbour, as if to watch the coming fray, and stand by for any possible use. By this time Carter and Pickman had divided the ghouls into three parties, one to meet each of the two invading columns, and one to remain in the town. The first two at once scrambled up the rocks in their respective directions, while the third was subdivided into a land party and a sea party. The sea party, commanded by Carter, boarded the anchored galley and rowed out to meet the undermanned galley of the newcomers, whereat the latter retreated through the strait to the open sea. Carter did not at once pursue it, for he knew he might be needed more acutely near the town. Meanwhile, the frightful detachments of the moon-beasts and almost-humans had lumbered up to the top of the headlands, and were shockingly silhouetted on either side against the gray twilight sky. The thin, hellish flutes of the invaders had now begun to whine, and the general effect of those hybrid, half-amorphous processions was as nauseating as the actual odor given off by the toad-like lunar blasphemies. Then the two parties of the ghouls swarmed into sight and joined the silhouetted panorama. Javelins began to fly from both sides, and the swelling meeps of the ghouls and the bestial howls of the almost-humans gradually joined the hellish whine of the flutes to form a frantic and indescribable chaos of demon cacophony. Now and then bodies fell from the narrow ridges of the headlands into the sea outside or the harbor inside, in the latter case being sucked quickly under by certain submarine lurkers whose presence was indicated only by prodigious bubbles. For half an hour this dual battle raged in the sky, till upon the west cliff the invaders were completely annihilated. On the east cliff, however, where the leader of the moon-beast party appeared to be present, the ghouls had not fared so well, and were slowly retreating to the slopes of the pinnacle proper. Pickman had quickly ordered reinforcements for this front from the party in the town, and these had helped greatly in the earlier stages of the combat. Then, when the western battle was over, the victorious survivors hastened across to the aid of their hard-pressed fellows, turning the tide and forcing the invaders back again along the narrow ridge of the headland. The almost-humans were, by this time, all slain, but the last of the toad-like horrors fought desperately, with the great spears clutched in their powerful and disgusting paws. The time for javelins was now nearly past, and the fight became a hand-to-hand contest of what few spearmen could meet upon that narrow ledge. As fury and recklessness increased, the number falling into the sea became very great. Those striking the harbor met nameless extinction from the unseen bubblers. But of those striking the open sea, some were able to swim to the foot of the cliffs and land on tidal rocks, while the hovering galley of the enemy rescued several moon-beasts. The cliffs were unscalable except where the monsters had debarked, so that none of the ghouls on the rocks could rejoin their battle line. Some were killed by javelins from the hostile galley or from the moon-beasts above, but a few survived to be rescued. When the security of the land parties seemed assured, Carter's galley sallied forth between the headlands and drove the hostile ship far out to sea, pausing to rescue such ghouls as were on the rocks or still swimming in the ocean. Several moon-beasts washed on rocks or reefs were speedily put out of the way. Finally, the moon-beast galley being safely in the distance, and the invading land army concentrated in one place, Carter landed a considerable force on the eastern headland in the enemy's rear, after which the fight was short-lived indeed. Attacked from both sides, the noisome flounderers were rapidly cut to pieces or pushed into the sea. Till by evening the ghoulish chiefs agreed that the island was again clear of them. The hostile galley, meanwhile, had disappeared, and it was decided that the evil jagged rock had better be evacuated before any overwhelming horde of lunar horrors might be assembled and brought against the victors. So by night Pickman and Carter assembled all the ghouls and counted them with care, finding that over a fourth had been lost in the day's battles. The wounded were placed on bunks in the galley, for Pickman always discouraged the old ghoulish custom of killing and eating one's wounded. And the able-bodied troops were assigned to the oars, or to such other places as they might most usefully fill. Under the low phosphorescent clouds of night, the galley sailed, and Carter was not sorry to be departing from the island of unwholesome secrets, whose lightless domed hall with its bottomless well and repellent bronze door lingered restlessly in his fancy. Dawn found the ship in sight of Sarkoman's ruined quays of basalt, where a few night-gaunt sentries still waited, squatting like black-horned gargoyles on the broken columns and crumbling sphinxes of that fearful city which lived and died before the years of man. End of Part 10 of The Dream Quest of Unknown Kharoff.
Thanks once again, Maureen. With Part 10 behind us, that only leaves us 4 more parts, and then we'll have finished The Dream Quest. But then what? Until next time. CthulhuPodcast.co.uk